Hi, this is Alex Kantrowitz. I'm the host of Big Technology Podcast, a longtime reporter and an on-air contributor to CNBC. And if you're like me, you're trying to figure out how artificial intelligence is changing the business world and our lives. So each week on Big Technology, I bring on key actors from companies building AI tech and outsiders trying to influence it, asking where this is all going. They come from places like NVIDIA, Microsoft, Amazon, and plenty more. So if you want to be smart with your wallet, your career choices, in meetings with your colleagues, and at dinner parties, listen to Big Technology Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Mexico wants to stop the flow of American firearms south across the border, where they end up in the hands of cartels. There is something in it for the U.S.
Stop the guns from going south, and we will be able to stop the fentanyl and other drugs from going north.
I'm Marco Werman. Today, new optimism that it could be done. Also on the show, worldwide Moldovans voted this weekend. And if it was a choice between Russia and Europe, they chose Europe. But it was not easy.
Even yesterday, there were bomb scares reported at polling stations.
Plus, one of the great conundrums of the human species.
We are so successful. It almost constantly seems to be at the expense of those around us.
Humans are so great, it hurts. That's all ahead today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for starting your week with us. Carolyn Beeler has a day off. We begin at the U.S.-Mexico border, where the flow of firearms from traffickers in the U.S. to cartels down south has long plagued communities in Mexico. Upwards of 70% of the guns recovered at crime scenes in Mexico are traceable to the U.S., 70%, with an estimated 250,000 illicit weapons moving south across the border every year. But this weekend, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum announced a joint initiative with the U.S. to disrupt that flow.
Por primera vez, lo primero que se discuta son las armas que vienen de Estados Unidos a México.
She praised the agreement, calling it the first of its kind. Leon Castellanos-Yankowitz is a senior researcher at the Asser Institute in The Hague. He told me today that part of what's new here is a real focus on gun trafficking, which has historically gotten lumped in with other issues like immigration.
Now what we're seeing is the singling out of this particular strand that is a game changer in the way in which both countries have been dealing with this problem, and I see it as a positive step.
Had the two countries been working relatively independently on the problem prior to this?
That is hard to tell. Over the past 5 years, there were a series of initiatives which bilaterally tried to bring the two countries closer to addressing this. There was also, we must not forget, a lawsuit that was filed by the Mexican government in 2021 in U.S. federal courts against the gun manufacturing industry. Right. And I think that what this did strategically was to put the issue on the table and say, okay, well, what are we going to do about this?
So you've been looking at the arms flow across the border for many years. Do you see this agreement as promising?
We have yet to see any concrete details and as to what kinds of methodologies and what kinds of policies they're thinking about rolling out and prosecutorial strategies as well, because the agreement, as it was announced by the State Department on Saturday, says that they're also going to focus on bringing some accountability and some of these bad apples, right, into courts. And that involves a justice system on both sides.
So let's get into some of the practicalities, some of the big ifs you just ran down there. There are differing legal frameworks to consider, like U.S. gun rights versus Mexico's gun restrictions. How will joint enforcement work given these differing approaches?
Law enforcement needs to be coordinated between Mexican and American authorities. I assume that the ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco on the U.S. side is going to be heavily involved. And I think that one of the underlying ways of sort of doing this right is going to depend on whether enough data is being shared from the U.S. side onto the Mexican side. Why is that, Marco? Because most of the weapons, according to both Mexican and American authorities, we've got between 250,000 and 1 million guns going from the U.S. into Mexico every year. And so getting that traceability information is going to depend on whether the U.S. government is able to facilitate that. And of course, we need some goodwill from the Mexican side, too, in terms of providing information about the cartels in real time, how they're getting their hands on these items and what they're doing with them.
Yeah, so on traceability, it sounds like intelligence sharing in real time between the U.S. and Mexican authorities, that's going to be crucial.
Exactly.
What kind of financial incentive is there for gun traffickers in the U.S. moving firearms south to Mexico?
Guns in Mexico are not readily available commercially. It is very difficult to purchase a firearm in Mexico. Mexico doesn't really have the culture of firearms that exists in the U.S. There's two gun shops in Mexico. They're both owned by the military.
Wait a minute, just two gun stores in all of Mexico?
We've got two gun stores in Mexico, and they're owned by the Mexican army. So in order to be able to purchase a firearm, which is legal, right? If you're using it for self-defense, you're a collector, you're a hunter, you got to go down to the army shop and buy it, and you need to present papers and register and all that. So the incentive here is, right, there's all of this supply north of the border, and there is a market south of the border. And the moment the gun crosses to the south, right, it increases its value. People will pay a lot of money to get their hands on a gun that is probably not available in Mexico. That's the incentive.
Well, I mean, drugs have found their way north into the U.S., sometimes through a series of very elaborate tunnels or even submarines. Despite news of this cooperation, what's the level of concern that these same schemes might be used to send guns south to Mexico?
So that is exactly the business model, right? Actually, a lot of times the fentanyl, et cetera, that is going into the United States, either from Mexico or via Mexico, right? We also know that there are supplies from other countries that are transiting through Mexico. In exchange for those shipments, U.S. criminal entities are sending guns south to pay for the drugs that are going north. And so what Mexico has said to the United States, right, in these bilateral negotiations, stop the guns from going south, and we will be able to stop the fentanyl and other drugs from going north.
You also mentioned accountability, Leon. Are gun manufacturers or dealers in the U.S. being held accountable when their products are trafficked into Mexico? And will this agreement for cross-border cooperation heighten the accountability?
If we're talking about going to court and being able to, right, sue bad actors and negligent companies which have sold items that are poorly designed, which are misfiring, or which are being sold in ways in which increases their likelihood of being trafficked down south, I think that is very hard right now, of course, because of constitutionally protected rights to gun ownership, but also because the U.S. gun industry enjoys certain immunities in the courts, right? So you have in the U.S., the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which gives the gun industry a pretty high degree of protections when it comes to bringing suits against it. So in Mexico's, just to go back to that case I mentioned, filed by the Mexican government, it went all the way up to the Supreme Court, Marco, and the Supreme Court decided that because of that immunity that the gun industry enjoys in the U.S., Mexico's case had to be thrown out, right? So that judicial accountability, well, we didn't get it. But I think that the case brought us different kinds of accountability, and perhaps the fact that Mexico brought this to the highest level of the American courts means that, you know, last week we saw the two governments sitting down at the table and being able to talk about this in a pretty sensible way, I think, thus far. And hopefully that will bring us some accountability by means of prevention, by means of awareness raising, and some new policies that we will see that will be implemented by the two countries.
Leon Castellanos-Jankowicz is a senior researcher at the Asser Institute in The Hague. In parts of the U.S., we're getting to the sweet spot of fall foliage season, and advice abounds on where to see the most brightly colored leaves. In the southern hemisphere, there's a much less frequent but arguably more impressive color display that's also happening right now. Parts of the Atacama Desert in northern Chile are carpeted with brightly colored blooming flowers. It's an incredible sight and a rare one, drawing tourists and botanists from across the globe. The world's TBS Isaiah was present for the previous mega bloom in the Atacama Desert a few years ago and sent this report.
It almost never rains here in the Atacama Desert. This area is so dry that it's used as a practice site for expeditions to Mars. But once or twice every decade, the skies open up and it rains, causing dormant seeds underground to grow. The result is a spectacular flowering desert that lasts only for a few weeks. I'm here in the middle of this desert where I see a huge esplanade of sand covered by pink flowers on one side, white flowers on the other side. There are yellow, orange, and violet flowers spread across the sand, but also insects and birds that come to the desert only during this moment. It's a surreal sight. It's like the desert stops being the desert for a little while. Carlos Silva and Ana Maria Acuña drove 23 hours from across the country to see the flowering desert.
Bueno, mi señora aquí, Anita, estuvo de cumpleaños.
Silva says this trip is a gift for his wife's birthday.
El regalo para mi señora era un entorno único, maravilloso y soleado.
It's a unique and wonderful phenomenon, he says. We wanted to come now because we don't know when it will happen again. The flowering desert only happens every 5 to 7 years. And it's difficult to predict, says Montserrat Barrientos. She's a tour guide for the blooming desert.
Es un juego entre temperatura y agua caída.
She tells me that there needs to be a perfect combination of precipitation and temperature for the flowers to bloom.
El desierto florido se han nombrado y datado más.
Barrientos says there are more than 200 species of plants flowering right now. She asks everyone to be careful when they step so they don't smash the flowers. The most emblematic one is a little pink flower that carpets large swaths of the desert. It's called pata de guanaco or guanaco feet. Guanaco is a wild llama from this area whose feet look similar to the leaves of the flower.
Por ejemplo, la hoja de la pata de guanaco es muy gorda.
She is showing me the leaves of this flower, this pink flower. They're actually almost attached to the floor, like the flower has feet, like the leaves are the feet, and they're very thick to store water. For many scientists, the flowering desert is an exciting event. It proves the resilience of certain types of flora in the world's driest desert. Benito Gomez Silva is a microbiologist at the University of Antofagasta. I visited his lab where he's studying microorganisms that are very resistant to extreme water scarcity in this desert.
Si una planta es capaz de resistir largos periodos de desecación,
if a plant can resist long periods of drought, he says, its genetic material has useful information for people who work on genetically modified plants. But the flowering desert is at risk. Climate change is one threat, says César Pizarro. He's a biologist with the Chilean Department of Conservation.
Podríamos tener también mayor periodo de sequía.
Longer drought, he says, or heavier rains could affect the frequency of the desert bloom, and eventually it could even stop happening. Another threat are traffickers who collect native plants or visitors who pluck flowers to bring home. Professor Benito Gomez Silva says there is a lot to learn.
Es trasladar la información que nos entregan nuestros pequeños hermanitos.
It's like translating the information that our little brothers, the microorganisms in the desert, provide for us, he says. Especially with our changing climate, Gomez Silva says these desert plant species could have a lot to teach us humans. For the world, I'm Tibi Saizea in the Atacama Desert in Chile.
TB reported that story during the last bloom in 2022. Chile's Forest Agency says the current flower bloom in the Atacama is at its peak right now through late October, and that some colors could stick around even through early December. It has been called a hotly contested cultural moment, tainted with scandal, utter mayhem. We are, of course, talking about the annual New Zealand Bird of the Year contest, After a campaign rife with meme battles and trash talk, the New Zealand falcon won the crown today. The conservation group Forest and Bird runs the annual event to raise awareness about New Zealand's native bird species. It started as a simple email poll 20 years ago. Now it's grown into a raucous national pastime. One year, New Zealanders voted for a bat to be Bird of the Year. And then there was a year comedian John Oliver goaded his fans to vote from abroad, prompting cries of election interference. This year's winning falcon could not be reached for comment as of airtime. Later this hour, an actual election in Moldova, and next, the U.S. president and the Israeli prime minister shoulder to shoulder at the White House this afternoon. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Mike Troy, host of the American Revolution podcast on the Airwave Media Network. This podcast is the origin story of the United States, how we went from colonies ruled by a king to the democratic republic that we have today. The American Revolution podcast tells the story of the revolution from beginning to end. Please subscribe for free. We're available on all major podcast platforms. I hope you will join me today on the American Revolution podcast.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump hosted the Israeli prime minister today at the White House. This was Benjamin Netanyahu's fourth meeting with Trump since he took office in January. Today they had plenty to talk about, almost 2 years since the Hamas attack of October 7th, which sparked Israel's war in Gaza. Trump is touting a 20-point plan for ending the war. The World's Matthew Bell is following the story. He's in our studio now. Matthew, what did Trump and Netanyahu actually agree on?
So about an hour after they were supposed to start, the two men walked out to the podiums, and President Trump talked about this really in the grandest way possible, Marco. He said, this isn't just about ending the war in Gaza. He said, this is one of the great days of civilization. And then he went into a long sort of on-script and off-script description of what he's looking at here. It's a 20-point plan, not just for ending the war in Gaza, as he put it, but for establishing peace across the Middle East. So in Gaza itself, Trump said this plan would mean the release of all the remaining Israeli hostages. That's about 20 people who are thought to still be alive. He said Gaza would be demilitarized. Israeli troops would pull out in phases. He talked about the aspirations of the Palestinian people, but he didn't talk about a future Palestinian state. And then he talked about putting together an international force for managing the affairs of the Gaza Strip after the war.
First, though, the fighting needs to stop. Who or what parties are involved in the plan for implementing the ceasefire for Gaza?
This was an interesting part of Trump's proposal, I thought. On the one hand, Trump criticized European states that have recently recognized a Palestinian state, but then he thanked the European leaders. He went on to thank leaders from specific countries across the Middle East. He named Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Turkey. He even named Indonesia, Pakistan, of course, Egypt. He said basically he's presenting this as a consensus, an international consensus that everyone agrees, as he put it, the war needs to stop. The hostages need to come back home. He even said he talked about Hamas. He said, look, of course, Hamas needs to agree to this. But he said, I think Hamas wants to end the war too. So just an interesting framing of this whole thing.
Benjamin Netanyahu was right by Trump's side. What did we hear from Benjamin Netanyahu today?
So this was a big deal, and people, of course, are watching the prime minister of Israel and every word that he's uttering on this, because he has been very hesitant to talk about ending the war. He's been talking about total victory in Gaza. But right out of the gate, Netanyahu comes to the podium and when it was his turn to talk, and he said, this plan will help Israel achieve its war goals. He said it will help bring home the hostages. It will end up in a defeat of Hamas, where Hamas will not be in charge of the Gaza Strip anymore. He said Gaza will be demilitarized. He also said, and here's where some of the stumbling blocks come in, I think, is he said there will be not only just no Hamas in control of Gaza in the future, but there will be no Palestinian Authority. That is going to be a big sticking point.
Yeah, why is that a big sticking point, and what are the other big challenges you see ahead for this plan to work?
So first of all, Palestinians are not giving up their aspirations for a state of their own. I was just watching an interview before the press conference started with a top Palestinian Authority official who said, we want a state. This has been the plan for decades, going back decades, and they're not going to give that up. And what's key about that is that the Arab allies that Donald Trump named to implement this plan feel the same way. That's a deal breaker for them. They're pushing for not just Palestinian aspirations, but they want Palestinians to be in control of their future. And that means running the affairs of the Gaza Strip for the longer term. So that's a big deal.
The World's Matthew Bell, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The longest underground rail tunnel in the world is nearly complete. It runs between Austria and Italy, passing deep beneath the Alps, nearly a mile deep. As our transportation correspondent Jeremy Siegel reports, the tunnel should cut travel times and carbon emissions.
Every year, 120 million people visit the Alps to hit the slopes and take in breathtaking views of some of the tallest and most expansive mountain ranges in Europe. But what about the view from inside the Alps? That's something far fewer people have seen, because getting in there requires massive machines that can cut through dense, rocky earth. Video shared with the world by BBTSE, the company behind the new tunnel, shows that the view from inside the Alps is breathtaking in its own right. But it's weird, kind of like something out of a horror movie. It's super dark, and you can barely make out what's going on. There's no natural light, but crew members clad in bright yellow vests and hard hats pass by with headlamps. It's hard not to wonder what's going through their minds as they dig and dig, with a mountain range above them and miles of tunnel behind them. Nowhere to go but forward.
Well, it doesn't feel like that strange once you've been doing this job.
Giorgio Malicelli is a seasoned excavator working as an operations manager on the tunnel project.
It's just an environment that's very familiar to you if you do this job on a daily basis. Of course, it has dangers.
Like collapses that can trap workers, sudden flooding from unexpected water sources, or accidents involving heavy machinery. But Malicelli's been lucky and recently got to experience one of the highlights of his career.
The final breakthrough in the pilot tunnel created the first transnational tunnel connection between Italy and Austria.
For the past 15 years, Malicelli and his crew on the Italian side and a separate group of workers on the Austrian side have been digging towards each other. And last week...
So we actually met with our colleagues from Austria, and that was a very defining moment for our project. It's the very first time that we broke through at the border.
When the milestone was reached, dignitaries from both sides of the border held a ceremony.
Questa galleria, quando entrerà in esercizio, come è stato ricordato...
Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni says the tunnel will revolutionize travel in Italy, Austria, and across Europe. Not just with passenger rail service that'll cut travel times from towns near the border from 80 minutes to 25, but with freight trains that'll significantly reduce the number of trucks winding up and down mountains on the congested Brenner Pass, spewing pollution into nearby communities.
Anche quella di decongestionare un'arteria di respiro europeo.
The 10.5 billion euro project, which is half funded by Italy and Austria, with the other half paid for by the EU, is still far from finished. The excavator, Giorgio Malicelli, says even with the first exploratory connection complete, there's still a lot of digging ahead to widen the tunnel. They'll use huge boring machines, machines that workers have lovingly named.
We always have women named Lilia, Vilma, and Olga. So we're waiting for these girls to come through.
Once the girls do come through, there's still structural work and track laying that needs to be done. Then trains have to be shipped in to actually run through. But if all goes according to plan, authorities say the tunnel will open to traffic in 2032. For The World, I'm Jeremy Siegel.
We'll be right back with more. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada, taking you to places you may never have heard of, and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The World has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Heading into the weekend, we had our eyes on Moldova, where a parliamentary election had become a tug of war for influence between Russia and the West. Yesterday, Moldovans headed to the polls and gave the pro-EU party a resounding victory. The party of President Maia Sandu came out far ahead of the pro-Russian opposition bloc. The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, joins us. So today will have been a day of celebration, Orla, for Moldova's president, Maia Sandu, and her pro-EU party. That result, though, for Sandu was much better than many of the polls had predicted. What happened?
It was, Marco, and even Maia Sandu herself appeared to be surprised that they managed to do so well today. They secured 50% of the vote. That was versus 24% for the pro-Russian opposition bloc. And I should point out, it's not necessarily that the polls got it wrong, but that a significant proportion of the population weren't actually polled. So the diaspora, for example, weren't part of the polls, and they make up more than a million people. Moldova, as you know, it's a tiny country. Its population is only around 2.4, 2.5 million. So that's a huge proportion of the electorate whose opinions just weren't known before the vote. Mm. Also on Friday afternoon, the country's electoral commission barred two pro-Russian parties from taking part in the election. They alleged there'd been problems with illegal financing and voter bribery. So they were removed from the ballot. And then the other thing is that there was a lot of undecided voters. We didn't know how a quarter of the population were going to vote before Sunday's election. So that was sort of all up in the air. And as someone in Moldova said to me earlier, part of the success maybe of Maia Sandu's party might be that the government has gotten better at cracking down on Russian interference, which has been a huge issue in previous elections.
Right. And there were a lot of allegations of Russian interference in the last few weeks. Do we know to what extent that actually happened or whether it played much of a part in the election results?
Yeah. And even yesterday, by the way, there were bomb scares reported at polling stations in Romania, in Italy, in Spain, in Belgium, and in the US, where Moldovans were voting.
Wow.
Yeah, we had repeated allegations of interference over the last few weeks. A lot of it appeared to be happening in social media. So many of the journalists and media monitors that I had spoken to said, you know, TikTok and Telegram were rife with disinformation, and TikTok just couldn't keep up with the number of accounts that were spreading pro-Russian propaganda and disinformation. You also had undercover reporters with international outlets who reported in the last few weeks that they'd been offered money to spread fake news about Maia Sandu and her party. You had dozens of arrests last week by Moldovan police who said people were being paid to incite riots on the streets of Moldova. So there was a lot of evidence that this was happening. Moscow, of course, has denied any reports of meddling in the election. How this impacted on voters is hard to tell, but you could probably surmise from looking at today's results that it didn't have a sizable impact. And most certainly, the pro-Russian bloc of parties, they're deeply disappointed with the results today.
So the pro-EU party has won in Moldova, but is EU membership for the country likely anytime soon?
That's a big question. I mean, right now the timetable is supposedly 2030, but there's a lot that needs to be done in that time. You had lots of positive soundings today. You had the EU Parliament chief, Roberta Metsola, tweeting that the future of Moldova is in Europe today. France, Germany and Poland, the leaders of those three countries, issued a joint statement congratulating Maia Sandu on the result. But the criteria for EU membership is strict. And Maia Sandu herself was asked by reporters this afternoon whether she thought membership is now a foregone conclusion.
I do believe in meritocracy. I do understand that the geopolitics can change and sometimes this can become an impediment. But we are determined to work very hard. We do have positive reports from Brussels on the steps that we have made so far, and we will do our best not to miss this opportunity.
The other thing to bear in mind is that Moldova is a very poor country. It's one of Europe's poorest, and corruption is still a big problem there. I was speaking to Nadine Gogu from the Independent Journalism Centre in Chisinau earlier, and she was saying Sandu's party has been making a lot of effort to try and crack down on it, including just late last week arresting a former senior politician who had fled the country and was accused of stealing over $1 billion.
The fact that one of the fugitive oligarchs that fled the country back in 2019, he was arrested in Greece. He was escorted to Chisinau and he is in jail right now. I assume that such examples also help. It's not so easy, you know, overnight this issue will not be solved, of course, but at least they are trying.
And one other thing, by the way, to say, Marco, is that when it comes to EU membership, you need a unanimous vote from all EU members. And there is a question of Hungary and Viktor Orban standing in the way. He may well veto an application to join the bloc.
Right. Orla, yesterday, even before the results were announced, the pro-Russian opposition leader in Moldova called for people to congregate outside parliament today and protest. Did that actually happen?
It did happen, and he must have been pretty disappointed by the number of people who showed up. I was watching some videos of it earlier. It appeared to be a few dozen people showed up. In fact, from what I could see, there appeared to be more journalists and camera crews there than actual protesters. He made a speech. He said that Maia Sandu's party had lost the result inside of Moldova, and it was only the diaspora that pushed them over the line. That's not true. We know from looking at the results today, 44% of voters inside Moldova voted for Sandu versus 28% for the pro-Russian bloc. So that's not true. But either way, you know, he's very unhappy with today's results for Sandu. It's a resounding victory. It's a vote of confidence in her, both as the leader of the country and for her pursuit for EU membership for Moldova.
The World's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, speaking with us about the results of the parliamentary election in Moldova, which favored the pro-EU party. Orla, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marco.
There was exciting paleontology news just before the weekend that a skull discovered in central China could be a million years old and that it belonged to a species that coexisted with the ancestors of modern humans. The announcement of this artifact adds a major piece to the puzzle of how we understand pre-human evolution, But it was not a total surprise to our next guest. British paleoanthropologist Ella Al-Shamahi studies the early ancestors of humans in a time period when there were at least 7 different species of humans roaming the Earth, possibly more. Al-Shamahi's new program with our GBH colleagues at NOVA helps explain why our species, Homo sapiens, is the only one left. The program is called Human, and Al-Shamahi spoke about it recently with the world's Carolyn Beeler.
So, Ella, this series starts 300,000 years ago when there were many species of humans. Who was around besides Homo sapiens back then?
There was a lot of us. And I think, first of all, that is surprising, shall we say, to a lot of folks. So there were the Neanderthals, which a lot of people have heard of. There was also a species called Homo naledi in Africa, Homo erectus. One of my absolute favorites was Homo floresiensis, which was a hobbit-like species. They lived only on the island of Flores in Indonesia. These humans came up to about 3.5 feet tall. And they lived on an island with giant carnivorous flesh-eating marabou storks that were taller than me, so over 6 feet, giant Komodo dragons, giant rats, but then elephant-like creatures, they're called stegodons, that were miniature. It was a wonderful, like a fantastical idea of what the world might have been. It's pretty fantastical, but it was real.
Yeah.
It boggles my mind to think about what that would have been like, because of course we're used to a world today where we are the only human species.
Right. So a huge diversity there, and we will get to why Homo sapiens survived and others did not later in our interview. But I wanted to raise this fact that I have heard before, but still astounded me when you said it in your series. As few as, 10,000 Homo sapiens made it out of Africa, and all of us today who have our origins outside of Africa are descendant from that very small population. How do we know this, that the number was so small?
First of all, it's worth saying that actually it's even more of a struggle than that, because actually we know that our species continuously left Africa, but the descendants of those early exoduses just didn't make it. They always became extinct. The exodus that made it, that led to those of us who live outside of sub-Saharan Africa, out of Africa rather, come from about 10,000 people, as you say, who left about 60,000 years ago. And we know that through genetic analysis, primarily through genetic analysis of people today, as well as ancient DNA.
Hmm. What was it about Homo sapiens that drove us to expand or allowed us to expand to all corners of the world?
And that is the question. And it's the question in some ways, one of the big questions of the series. What is it? I think there are a number of factors. We are an incredibly cooperative species, which sounds, I think, really shocking to a lot of people to describe us as the friendly species.
When we think about all the war and conflict we've had over human history. Yeah,
there are definitely legitimate questions about that, but we are incredibly friendly. And what that means is we tend to invent. We touch on this concept in the series called cumulative culture, which is the idea that every generation builds upon the previous generation's science, technology, art, etc. And what happens is if you have a very, very cooperative species, that just like booms, basically. And I think that is a huge part of it. It meant that we could enter into areas because we were willing to adapt our technology to those environments. But I also think that there is something about us in terms of our curiosity. You know, I always think about that first crossing to Australia, which was a crossing over water. And it, you know, it was done on rafts and it was open ocean and people couldn't see what was on the other side. So they would have been, you know, on these rafts for days. And yet hundreds of them, we think, did it. And it makes you wonder, because I don't think that's just about a species that's really good at inventing things. I think that's also, there's something else going on there. In a similar way to the way you and I might look at a landscape and go, ooh, what's on the other side of that mountain? Let's go just check it out. That kind of curiosity, that imagination. I think our ancestors had that as well in a unique way.
I'm speaking with British paleoanthropologist Ella Al-Shamahi, who hosts a new documentary series airing on many PBS stations. It is called Human, and it explores the mystery of out of the many species of human that used to exist, we now only have one, Homo sapiens. Ella, you mentioned new technologies developed that allowed us to adapt to new environments. One of those pieces of new technology is arrowheads that were made out of bone instead of stone, as they previously were. Can you tell us what the significance of that is in terms of the story of human adaptation?
So this was in Sri Lanka that arrowheads in the rainforest were found that were made of monkey bones because the bones of the monkeys were lighter and were actually better than stone to hunt the monkeys with in the tree canopies. You've got to imagine, you know, monkeys are jumping around. So actually having these much lighter arrowheads, it works much better.
Yeah, and it tells the story of how these early humans adapted from hunting whatever they were hunting out on open ground to something that the arrows needed to reach up high into the tree canopy and needed to be fast to move around these, to get these very quickly moving monkeys.
Very much so. It's, you know, it's adapt or die, and certainly by this point, our species was really keen on adapting.
Yeah. So one of the people you feature in this documentary series, Sheila Colson at the University of Oslo, found a really interesting clue about early humans in a cave in Botswana in 2004. Here is a clip of Sheila telling you about it.
One of the things found was an extremely large number of tools that appeared to be manufactured and then just left there in pristine condition.
So what did paleontologists learn from this big cache of unused tools?
Why go to the effort of making these beautiful tools only to intentionally burn them before use or intentionally break them and destroy them? The obvious interpretation for that kind of behavior is that it's ritual. It's an offering.
Mm-hmm.
Ritual is very unique to us.
To Homo sapiens specifically, as opposed to any other species of human?
Yeah, I mean, there is some evidence of potential ritual within the Neanderthals, for sure. But I think the thing with ritual is it indicates a mind which is seeing things which are not in front of them. Again, it indicates a mind which is thinking about the unknown. The magnificent thing about this cave is that there is a huge rock outcrop that kind of looks like a snake or a serpent. And it's very hard to see that snake-like figure and to see those stone tools that are beautiful, that have been destroyed intentionally without use, and not think, right, that is some kind of offering, that is some kind of ritual. And most importantly, that is a species that is entering into a new way of thinking.
Mm.
And I, as you can probably tell, I'm kind of pausing a bit as I'm talking about this because it's actually, it's beautiful to see and it transcends in some way.
Yeah, I can hear the sense of awe in your voice, and that comes through in this documentary series as well. We started this conversation talking about the wide diversity of early humans that existed. All the other species, besides Homo sapiens, including Neanderthals and the hobbits, they eventually died away. Is there, you know, an overarching explanation for why we survived and those several other species of humans did not?
We present a few different arguments in the series. I think it's really important as a caveat to also say that if you were to put 10 paleoanthropologists in the room, we would all have slightly different opinions. Some of us might even have very different opinions. I think cooperation is probably a very, very big factor. I think the climate was also changing, and it looks like we were better able to cope with that change. Luck is also a potential factor. There were just times where it looks like we got lucky.
Mm.
But I can't understate enough, us being a cooperative species, us having cumulative culture, us being inventive and creative in the way that we were and are, it's remarkable. I reflect on this a lot because I don't know what to do with our species, because on the one hand, our ancestors were so clearly brilliant, so clearly resilient, inventive, And as a result, you know, we're here, because if they weren't that, realistically, we probably wouldn't be here. On the other hand, our ancestors and us as a species, we are so successful that it almost constantly seems to be at the expense of those around us, whether it's humans or today in animals. And I think that makes us quite a complicated species, because you both can't help but be in awe and respect and et cetera, et cetera. But also there is this side effect, and it's quite a profound one.
Ella Al-Shamahi is a British paleoanthropologist and host of the new 5-part series from our colleagues at NOVA. It's called Human. Ella, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. Take care.
That series, produced by our GBH colleagues at the science program NOVA, is streaming now on YouTube. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. It was a spy swap that changed the course of relations between the U.S. and Cuba, the stuff of recent history, and now a podcast from Foreign Policy Magazine and Audible. It's called I Spy, the U.S., Cuba, and the Secret Deal That Ended the Cold War. Dan Efron is the host. He's also executive editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. Dan joined me to look back on the whole story, starting with an American arrested in Cuba in 2009.
Alan Gross was a private contractor. He was subcontracted by a government agency, a U.S. government agency, USAID, to go to Cuba and install internet hubs. This was a little bit more than a decade ago. It's actually 15, 16 years ago. He went in 2008 and made 5 trips over the course of a year. And on his last trip, he was arrested by Cubans who felt that what he was doing was covert and illegal there. Internet is controlled, highly controlled, certainly was in Cuba at the time. They put him on trial and sentenced him to something like 15 years in prison.
So I have to be honest with you, Dan, at the time of this whole episode and listening to your podcast, I assumed that Alan Gross was a spy or a bumbling idiot. I mean, as you say, he was setting up internet hubs in Cuba so Cubans could bypass censorship laws. I mean, he's either very naive or so out of it that he shouldn't have been working for a USAID subcontractor in the first place. Is it possible he did not know what he was doing was against Cuban law?
I think he was aware that what he was doing was dicey. I think he was aware that he was, either breaking the law or going against policy in Cuba. He was certainly aware that there are censorship laws in Cuba. He's certainly not a spy. He wasn't a part of a spy agency. He wasn't trained by any spy agency. He was contracted by USAID, a civilian agency of the State Department. As he goes along, he becomes more and more aware. I think what he's telling himself all along is, well, if I get caught, they'll just kick me out of the country. I don't think he imagined that he would be put on trial, suspected of spying, and sentenced to this long prison term.
One of the things Alan Gross told you about was the pressure he was under while in custody when Cuban authorities were trying to get a confession out of him. Here's a recording you have of Gross recalling some of the threats.
And some of the stuff was threatening, which I, ultimately took with a grain of salt, because they threatened to pull out my fingernails, but they didn't.
I mean, Alan Gross is almost bemused by this attempt by Cuban officials at extracting information from him. What's going on here, Dan?
So this is immediately after he's arrested. They're trying to get real information out of him. They're telling him they think he's a spy, a CIA spy. But they're also making these threats that they don't seem to follow through on. And Alan, he's kind of a funny guy, but this was serious stuff. He ended up spending years in a Cuban prison in circumstances that were very unpleasant.
So Washington wants to get Alan Gross out of jail, and it's willing to make a deal. Tell us what this deal could include.
Yeah, Obama is elected. He begins his term in office in 2009. And irrespective of Alan Gross, Obama has this thought about Cuba. Why are we still fighting the Cold War with Cuba? When the Cold War ended decades earlier, why do we still have this relationship of hostility with the Cubans? And he is looking for an opportunity to have a dialogue with the Cuban government, the Castro regime in Cuba. But Cuba's arrest of Alan Gross kind of gets in the way. The way the Obama administration sees it, you can't now begin a negotiation and make compromises with a country that is holding this American citizen in prison. And so it sort of stymies this whole approach, this whole policy of trying to open up to Cuba. And instead, the focus becomes, how can we get Alan out?
You spent a lot of time with Alan Gross. You also managed to interview some Cubans for the story, including the head of the Cuban intelligence network that operated in Miami in the 1990s. His name, Gerardo Hernandez. Tell us about him.
So pretty quickly, it becomes clear that what the Cubans would want in return for Alan is for the United States to release this group of spies that came to be known as the Cuban Five. These were Cuban intelligence agents who had been sent in the 90s to Florida, to Miami, to basically embed themselves in these groups of Cuban Americans who hated Castro, who were trying to undermine Cuba or the Cuban regime. The Cuban regime saw these groups as a threat and embedded these Cuban intelligence agents in these organizations in Miami. Gerardo Hernandez was the head of that intelligence cell. So he had come here illegally as a spy under an assumed name with an assumed identity and kind of went about doing this intelligence gathering and sending it back to Cuba until one day in the mid-90s, the FBI is on to him and eventually they arrest him and they sentence him to multiple life sentences.
So back to the timeline, Dan. In Obama's second term, the U.S. and Cuba are negotiating this prisoner swap, and they decide at some point to expand the deal to include diplomatic relations. Tell us what happened.
At some point, the American negotiator, and this is Ben Rhodes, who was National Security Council, very close to Obama, puts on the table this broader proposal. Let's not only exchange prisoners, but let's normalize relations. For the first time since 1959 or 1961, really, when relations were severed. And it takes some time for the Cubans to both accept that this is a real offer, but also come around to the idea that, yes, this is beneficial for both sides.
So a lot of twists and turns, but the two sides do reach an agreement. President Obama makes the historic trip to Havana in 2016. The Rolling Stones play a big show there. But then the following year, Donald Trump pretty much tears up the agreement. Where are we at today between these two countries?
Right. Trump tears up the deal. And at this moment, relations are harsh. The hostility is high. The economic situation in Cuba is very, very hard. More than 10% of the Cuban population has fled the island, found a way to leave the island over the last couple of years. And many of those people who are fleeing have ended up at America's borders, trying to cross either legally or illegally.
It all feels very Cold War, which, of course, is technically over. And yet the divide represented by the Florida Strait feels as wide as ever. When it comes to the U.S. and Cuba, what is the lesson, do you think, from the Alan Gross saga?
Well, that negotiations can work, that when the two sides sit down in good faith, in this case, start with something small and build on it, they can come up with a deal, that there are enough things in common between what the United States wants and what Cuba wants, that the two countries can have normal, peaceful relations. I think that's the takeaway from the agreement itself.
That's Dan Efron with Foreign Policy Magazine and host of Audible's I Spy podcast. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll catch you right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. macfound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Bill Resnick, Ron Cunniff, Deet and Paul Meserve, Patrice F. and Cameron J., Merle Kurtzrock, and George Zimmerman. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.